The following podcast is part of the MindBodySpirit.fm podcast network.
Support for this show comes from the National Wellness Institute, committed to providing the tools, trainings, and resources to propel your career in wellness. Become a member today at nationalwellness.org.
From Spirituality and Health magazine, I'm Rabbi Rami, and this is Essential Conversations. Our guest today is Dr. Joel Bennett. He's president of Organizational Wellness and Learning Systems. And this organization, the acronym is OWLS, delivers transformational well-being consultation to workplaces. Dr. Bennett's the author of 5 books, including Raw Coping Power and Heart-Centered Leadership. And you can read his essay, 7 Traits of Positive Audacity, in the September-October 2016 issue of Spirituality and Health magazine, and his current essay, 5 Steps to Solving the Opioid Crisis, in the May-June 2018 issue of the magazine. Joel Bennett, welcome to Essential Conversations.
I'm so happy to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Oh, it's our pleasure. I mentioned both magazines, the 2016 essay and the 2018 essay, because I hope that we're going to get a chance to look at them both. They seem to me to go together in some sense. But let's begin with the current one, 5 Steps to Solving the Opioid Crisis. I guess I want your general take on this. Sometimes I think that our current opioid crisis is really just the latest expression of an existential crisis built into the Western psyche. Something like, you know, life shouldn't be suffering. You know, suffering is really punishment. That's sort of what the book of Genesis tells us. It's not supposed to be built into the way things are. I mean, that's Buddhism that tells you life is suffering. That in the West, we have this illusion that we could get rid of suffering, and that what you call pharmophilia, the love of drugs, is our way of doing it. So what's your take on this? Is it something new, or is this just part of our existential crisis in the West?
Well, I wonder, people have a hard time with pain, right? We all have a hard time with pain. That's not going to go away. And different religious and philosophical orientations have an answer to that. And you know that from a lot of what you've written and talked about. I think in the West, it's a question of, can we make money off of it, right? So, to answer your question, it's very deeply existential to the human condition and the spiritual journey. It's a question of whether or not people wrestle with it, are allowed to wrestle with it, or whether they're offered a dangling, you know, shiny bauble to say, here, you don't have to wrestle with it. We're going to give it to you for $49.95, right? So I hope that at least is in the direction of where you want to go with this. So.
Well, okay, you bring up the jaded side of me, I guess, when you talk about money. Yeah, I understand that, and I get what you're saying, and that certainly is a big part of everything that happens in the capitalist civilization. But you trace it back. I mean, you know, this is a short essay, but still, you trace it back in a sense to, the Fountain of Youth and all the different things. I mean, it seems to me you go back hundreds of years. The impression is you're going to go back hundreds of years and find, you know, an alchemy in different ways that we're always trying to avoid pain. Whereas, you know, the Buddha say it's just a built-in part of the system and pills aren't going to help. A change of consciousness is what's necessary. So do you see a change of consciousness being necessary, a necessary component to solving the opioid crisis?
Oh, yes, most definitely. In fact, I would argue that the current opioid crisis can serve as a crucible for awakening. That, you know, it's that quote from Jung that says there's no coming to consciousness without pain. And in the article with the space I had to try and say, no, wait, maybe it's the other way around. You know, maybe with the ability to monitor and be more mindful and bring in our spiritual resources that do go back thousands of years, we can talk about the Rig Veda and how the soma that's talked about even earlier, you know, before there was even this idea of the fountain of youth, that there's something deep inside the soul of humanity, the common humanity, that is aspiring to awaken from pain. And when we've gotten to the point where we're selling things and people are making money, and more and more you're seeing in the news lately that the pharmaceutical companies knew what they were doing, that maybe we need to start realizing that maybe this model isn't really what we thought it was. And so I'm seeing it as a positive and an awareness of how deeply addicted our society is and how deeply we look. You know, one of my teachers was Ann Wilson Schafe, who wrote a book called When Society Becomes an Addict. And she talked a lot about how all addictive processes require looking outside of ourselves, something that's called external referencing, where the locus of control is out there. Something out there is going to fix this. And we know that from, at least I think from what I've read with you and much of what's in spirituality and health, it's not out there, right? It's not out there. And here now it's come to the head. It's come to its head, right? Of course, you know, there's nothing wrong with pharmaceuticals per se. We need things. It's great that we have science, but it's been co-opted and misused and is misaligned. So I'm hoping that we can move from this crisis orientation, this crisis intervention mode. I mean, people are dying. Just yesterday, somebody I didn't even know, a colleague, they just told me my sister died from an opioid addiction. It's going on, and our heads are in the sand for the most part. So I'm hoping that maybe there's another way to be conscious about our pain and our mortality. And I'd like to go to the other side from your jaded, cynical side here, right? Play both ends.
Okay, I'll go with you. That's fine. So in the article, you talk about selecting a healthy alternative to opioids. And you list a bunch of things, and we don't have time to go through all of them, but you list things like, I'm just going to quote you. You say, consider essential oils, herbal teas, massage, mind-body practices like Tai Chi, yoga, Qigong, and mindfulness. Do you think, because I mean, you sound very hopeful, do you think that message that there are these other alternatives, these non-addictive alternatives, you think that actually gets through? Especially when you talked a couple of years ago about, and this is a phrase I loved, or word you coined that I loved, called McMindfulness, which sort of like the McDonald's of mindfulness. So how do you work those two together? That I'd like to believe that, for example, mindfulness, we're going to rediscover this thing big time, and it's going to transform society. But then it becomes like everything else in a capitalist society, McMindfulness, and they're just selling us mindfulness franchises and all kinds of exercises and the right cushions and the right clothes and, you know, all of that. So how do you understand that challenge?
So I want you to know, Rami, that I feel like we're playing chess here. We're going back to the jaded square, right? I was moving in another direction, but we can go back to the McMindfulness. It's true. These are things we need to be wary of. We've always, like I said in the article, you know, the whole idea of the snake oil, salesman, right? So the way that it all comes together, and I put on my scientist practitioner hat, we're talking about the fact that, number one, many of those practices you listed have a strong evidence base behind them. Mindfulness meditation, when practiced right, does have an impact on pain reduction. Qigong has been shown in study after study to deal with things like stress and anxiety and things that exacerbate the reactivity to pain. So the truth is that the research is out there, and those characteristics are actually from the National Institutes of Health, those qualities, Tai Chi, progressive relaxation, et cetera, massage. So that's the first side of it. Those things do work. And many of them are low cost, alternative health, complementary and alternative health practices. The issue is that people are not educated around them as primary prevention tools. In our empowered health consciousness model training, which I just trained people today in, what we're talking about is educating people in an empowered way so that they can internally referent themselves and check in with their bodies and their motives for dealing with pain, dealing with the need for energy for the stimulants, dealing with their anxiety and sedatives and relaxants that are out there on the pharmaceutical market. So instead of the intense consumer advertising that is being done, the direct-to-consumer advertising in the pharmaceutical industry, and the immediate, you know, first choice for your doctor is to just give you a prescription, we need to re-educate people about owning and empowering themselves around all of these other very low-cost alternative health practices for the purposes of enhancing their health consciousness, building their health consciousness. You know, I do want to go back to the spiritual reference. You know, there is a overlap between health consciousness and divine consciousness, and the whole idea of the body as the temple, and the idea of the Sabbath and taking time out to remember that is gone. It's gone. It's fraying in our society. So when you look at the whole picture, McMindfulness, right, the co-optation of a very sacred practice that was originally about seeking enlightenment. It wasn't about mindfulness and Vipassana and Satipatthana was not about relieving stress. And there are teachers who originally came over and brought that over who would say that if you're here to reduce your stress, you're here for the wrong reason. If you're here to seek liberation, you're here for the right reason. But unfortunately, like everything else in our culture, things get co-opted. McMindfulness being one example. So the overarching and most important message, which I think you align with, is getting people back to their own understanding of their soulfulness and how they can treat their body from that perspective and use practices that will help them do that. I hope that kind of helped answer.
Yeah, no, I think you articulated that very clearly, and it makes me wonder if, and this is how I, in my mind, this is how I was tying the two essays together, whether what you're calling liberation at the moment couldn't also be understood in your concept of positive audacity. Do you see a connection there? It just seems to me that, because you define audacity as bold disrespect, and it seems to me that liberation, enlightenment, is a bold, is a freeing of yourself from the BS that is fed to us continually by the normative culture, and that enlightenment shatters that, breaks through from that, and so does positive audacity. Is this too far a stretch, or are you?
No, I mean, so saith the Zen master, right? I mean, that was the whole point of striking of the student, right? To wake the student up. And we have to wake ourselves up now. And so, no, it's directly related to that. The idea of positive audacity is that we are willing to take on the problem. We're willing to go into the pain, right? We're willing to speak truth to power. You know, we're willing to say something that might be considered disrespectful, because what's more important is truth, you know, our truth and speaking our truth. So positive audacity is very much related to this idea of waking up, yes. And it's also related to the idea of not settling for the status quo, which would be something like always use a prescription drug when you have a problem. That was the status quo.
And that's where this your notion of disrespect comes. It's sort of what we used to call question authority.
Yes, what we used to call question authority. Yes. Yes. Yeah.
So you've got this great line in the Audacity essay where I'm just going to read it to you and see what you think about it now, a couple of years later. You wrote, "The teachings of the Buddha and Jesus and the Declaration of Independence are audacious in the extreme. But so was Adolf Hitler. How can we discern positive from negative audacity?" That's your question. How do we discern positive from negative audacity? So how do we do that?
Well, I think that's the question on everybody's mind in the era of Donald Trump, right? So I know we're going all over the place here, but that discernment is really what I think is needed. And how we do that is, gosh, I'd love to ask you that question. I think, you know, I think this could be ideally a dialogue between us. I think how we discern, positive audacity from negative audacity has to do a lot with that internal referencing that I was talking about earlier, you know, going with our gut and training our children and the people in our communities and our families to openly discuss and contemplate, that's a key word, what they think is true for themselves, instead of arguing about it, instead of taking a dialectic about it, instead of being, always going to some sort of sweeping, dogmatic approach. I think that's the first thing, is to recognize dogma for what it is, to recognize the lemming effect for what it is when everybody is jumping on a bandwagon, which is, I think, what's great about the American culture is the idea of innovation and autonomy, to the sense of being able to say, huh, this is BS, and finding a way to work with others in communities of practice that you're seeing all over the place, actually, to kind of hold a torch to or hold a light to, how can we work together to find the right solution and not go with one side or the other side in this polarized dialectic that we're seeing in our culture. So I think discernment is a tough one. And that's why I thought I'd love to hear what you think about it too.
Well, I mean, very quickly, my sense of it is that it's positive if it serves the flourishing of self and others, and negative if it serves neither or only one or the other. My concern, and you raised this earlier, just a few moments ago, my concern is that in a sense, we're being made so dumb that we can't, I don't know if we can discern things anymore, that we're so locked into these competing tribes, with each with its own, truth in quotes, that reality gets lost somewhere in the narrative. And that's why what I liked about what you're saying is this, the challenge of audacity is to say, you know what? I don't know. And you don't know. And I'm going to challenge these things. I'm going to question these things to see where they lead, rather than just, oh, this is my red tribe saying this, so I'm going to say it too. Or this is my blue tribe saying it, and I'm going to say that, that's my truth now because my tribe is saying it. I'm so fearful that we are becoming tribal to the extreme and incapable of this bold, audacity, this positive audacity. Let me ask you, because we're just about out of time, let me ask you one last question about resilience. Because I think, we hear all the time about resisting. And you're talking about, I don't know, I don't think they're opposites, but I wonder if resilience is a kind of resistance to the madness of our moment.
I love it. I love everything you're saying. I hope we can talk again, because yes, I do think it is. But like I was talking about the opioid epidemic as a crucible, when you start peeling into it, there's really much more that it's trying to show us, you know, and there's more potential for growth that can come out of it instead of reacting to it in a crisis way. In a parallel way, resilience is the same thing. Resilience suggests that there's a potential here, that resilience, if it is only, or if I understand what you're saying, is only like our resistance to the madness, then it's not really revealing its true potential. That is, resilience, if you notch it up just a little bit more, resilience turns into thriving. Resilience turns into flourishing. And that's that positive psychological turn to resilience. So it's just not being resilient for resilience sake, which is where a lot of the writings are now. And we do a training on from resilience to thriving. And the whole idea is training people to understand, or educating ourselves to understand, just like with powered health consciousness. Hey, if I'm only bouncing back all the time, right, then I'm going to be worn out, you know? And if I'm only being resilient, so I'm learning how to push through the madness, then that's not really serving anything. So it's sort of like digging into resilience a little bit more and seeing the seed that it's there trying to tell us to enhance our well-being, to actualize, or what I call potentiate our well-being. So resilience is a step along the way.
We are going to have to hold it there, unfortunately. I mean, there's so much more to be said about this. Luckily, we have your two articles and your five books that people can get go deeper into what you've been saying, because it's really important. Our guest today was Dr. Joel Bennett. You can read Dr. Bennett's essay, Seven Traits of Positive Audacity, in the September-October 2016 issue of Spirituality and Health magazine, and his essay, Five Steps to Solving the Opioid Crisis, in the May-June 2018 issue. For more information on his books and his work, please visit organizationalwellness.com. Joel, thanks so much for being with us on Essential Conversations.
It was an essential pleasure.
Thanks. Support for this show comes from the National Wellness Institute, committed to providing the tools, training, and resources to propel your career in wellness. Become a member today at nationalwellness.org. Before we sign off, let me remind you that this year is the 20th anniversary of Spirituality and Health magazine. As part of our celebration, I'm leading an interspiritual tour of the Holy Land. This is part tour, part pilgrimage, as we engage in contemplative practices linked to the various sites we will visit, Jewish, Christian, Muslim, and Baha'i. For more information, please visit us at spiritualityhealth.com/holyland-with-Rami. Essential Conversations with Rabbi Rami is a project of Spirituality and Health magazine. Please log in to spiritualityhealth.com to subscribe to the magazine in print or digital formats, and to download the iTunes app for this podcast. If you enjoy the podcast, please leave us a review. Essential Conversations is produced by Ezra Baker, and our program coordinator and executive producer is Alma Tassi. I'm Rabbi Rami. Thanks for listening.